welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The key foreign policy issues on the ballot in the 2020 presidential elections, and how different are the visions of Biden and Trump of the American role in the world? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. This week, the final presidential debate of the 2020 election season was held, and normally the final debate is on issues of foreign policy. This year, though foreign policy issues were raised, it was nowhere near as extensive as previous years. So on today's show, we're going to examine what's on the ballot on issues of foreign policy and what are some of the key differences between the two candidates, President Trump and Vice President Biden, and the likely future of American foreign policy, depending on the election outcome. I'm joined today on the panel with Mark Boyer, who is the Board of Trustees Distinguished Professor of Geography at the University of Connecticut. He is the author of The Adaptation Imperative and is also the Executive Director of the International Studies Association. And Peter Trumbore, who is Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Oakland University. He is the author of Brexit, the Border, and Political Conflict Narratives in Northern Ireland with Andrew Alsayek. First, I'm going to ask you, Mark, one of the areas that there seems to be a pretty clear distinction between President Trump and his predecessors has been what's been a pretty longstanding U.S. commitment to a liberal institutional order that's frequently described as rules-based. First of all, what is that order, and is it fair to say that this president really does differ from previous presidents in his commitment to liberal institutions and liberal rules?
Thanks, Doug. Yes, I think he does very much differ from his predecessors, and the whole sort of ethos, and I would say it's not really a policy, it's more just sort of an idea of this of America First that came out in the first inauguration speech and in many other things along the way, really rejects the kinds of roles that the U.S. has played in the global system since at least the end of World War II. And so when we see that role decay under the Trump administration, we're really talking about a decay in American structural power, that it's not necessarily that the United States gets its way all the time, but that the institutions and the structures that exist in the system certainly were made in the U.S. image and really designed in many respects by the United States and the policymakers at the end of World War II. And by rejecting so many of those institutions, you're moving into a world where American power perhaps doesn't matter as much. And so I would even argue that the Trump approach of America First may ultimately produce, particularly if it continues for another 4 years, will end up with America irrelevant. You have the withdrawal from Paris Climate Accord. You have the withdrawal during a pandemic from the World Health Organization. You have the withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. And the list can go on and on and on from all of the places where American foreign policy has been centered on building institutions to constrain behavior and to promote positive behavior from an American and a Western perspective more generally.
And Pete Trumbore, the president actually last night had indicated that he strengthened institutions like NATO because of his insistence that European countries contribute more to defense, and that by playing kind of a stronger leadership role, he's actually strengthening those organizations. Is he right?
No. You know, Trump has done as much to weaken the unity of NATO as he has to weaken the other institutions that Mark mentioned. Trump has cast doubt on whether or not the United States would honor its treaty obligations to come to the defense of fellow NATO members in the event that they're subject to external aggression. And going so far as a year or so ago, maybe 2 years ago, to basically ask, why the hell would we go to defend Latvia? Why would you send Americans to go to the Baltics, right, in the face of Russian aggression? What Trump complained about is an issue that American presidents have complained about for decades, and that is that we carry more of the overall defense burden for our allies than they do. And in some ways, they get a chance to free ride on our willingness to foot that bill. Trump is not the first person to raise this, not the first American president or defense secretary to raise these questions. there's sort of two pieces of this with Trump. One is that it is a long-standing position that he's held going back to the 1980s, that America's allies rip us off. This was an argument he made about Japan in the 1980s vis-a-vis China. So that's the first thing. This is just one of these ideas he's always had in his head. The other idea that I think has been part and parcel of his approach to foreign policy is that he sees every relationship in transactional terms. And he fundamentally misunderstands or mischaracterizes exactly what our NATO allies have done. He talks as if when they increase their defense spending, somehow they are paying the United States and therefore we get to spend less. That's absolutely not what's going on. They're simply increasing their commitments and increasing their own defense budgets. So no, I mean, I think that anytime the president talks about any role that he has played in strengthening institutions or strengthening international relationships, I think he's just wildly off base.
And one of the strange things about that is the assumption that if European countries were paying more for defense, the U.S. could actually cut their defense spending. That's the opposite of what the U.S. has been doing. So kind of have to
And certainly it's the opposite of what he himself has boasted about, that he gives more to our big, beautiful, powerful military than ever before. So yeah, it's not like that we are then scaling back our commitments, at least not monetarily.
Mark Boyer, sorry. The other part that I don't think he understands, even if you pursue this from a transactional standpoint, is everything else that the United States gets from the allies and from their friends, whether it's, you know, help in stabilizing global currencies or intervention in different places of the world where we're not going to send troops, but the Canadians are going to send peacekeepers. And the list goes on. And by being the primary provider within NATO of military hardware and military personnel, and the list goes on, we get lots of other things that we wouldn't be able to spend on. And that is, even in a transactional way, is something I just don't think he comprehends.
This is Pete. There's a long list of things I think we could argue that the president doesn't quite understand. And I was struck last night in the debate, and maybe Doug was going to get to this later, Trump still seems to not understand how tariffs work. He seems to be under the impression that when the United States slaps a tariff on a Chinese import, that somehow the Chinese government or the Chinese economy pays that tax. No, that tax is levied on American consumers. That tax is levied on American corporations that are importing parts and materials from China. You know, so he boasted last night in the debate about, you know, this 20-some billion dollar bailout for Iowa farmers. And I think Biden rightly pointed out that that's just money that has been taken out of the pockets of other American taxpayers. It's not money that's been paid by China. So, you know, we could probably spend the next half hour talking about all the things that the president doesn't understand about policy, politics, international relations. But I guess life and time is too short.
The president actually has raised some pretty valid concerns about Chinese behavior, for instance, in trade, issues of protection of intellectual property and regulations, the use of certain non-tariff barriers to trade to try to block the Chinese market or to try to compel companies that want to invest in China to have to create joint ventures with Chinese companies. But one of my concerns had been that if the U.S. wanted to try to enforce the trade order and the idea of enforcing a liberal rules-based order as opposed to just power certainly would play a significant role. And also the role that the U.S. sort of picking trade fights with Europe, with Canada, et cetera, rather than building a coalition where it's not just the U.S. taking on China, but it's all of the other major trading partners taking them on. I point this out to raise the question, and I'll ask this first of you, Mark. We know that there's a partisan difference in unilateralism. Republicans tend to be more unilateral. Democrats tend to be more multilateral. Is Trump kind of outside of your typical partisan difference in what seems to be a pretty firm commitment to unilateralism?
Oh, yes, absolutely. He's outside of the norm and certainly outside of the bounds. I mean, even if you look at Reagan or, you know, Bush 1 or even Bush 2, there was a fair amount of engagement with global institutions, you know, perhaps not the climate regime under Bush 2 by any means. But you did see that. And I think that's the philosophical difference between Trump and almost everybody else. It's whether whether it's on China trade, whether you try to hark back and use a Reagan administration term, constructively engage China, or whether you punitively engage them and try to isolate them. Frankly, the isolating China isn't going to work given the size of the economy and the places that they're involved around the world with all sorts of infrastructure projects, the Belt and Road Initiative, and so on and so forth. I don't think that's gonna happen. And so you need to think about what are the levers. And as you pointed out, having some kind of collaboration with the Europeans, with the Japanese to try to do this in a collective manner is much more likely to succeed than a unilateral initiative.
So this is Pete. I think one of the things that people like us tend to forget is that Trump brought to the office literally no understanding of the international order, the sort of the rules of the system. You know, and this was a point of pride, right? He was outside the system. He's not a politician. He repeated that last night in the debate. But at some level, I think it's almost unfair to sort of hold Trump to the standard of prior presidents, because Trump brings none of the intellectual capital to the job that would have required him or would have allowed him to really understand the way that these systems, norms, and institutions work. And that said, right, this was one of those reasons why people took a slight bit of comfort early on that he surrounded himself with some relatively competent people in the foreign affairs sort of realm. Maybe not Rex Tillerson, but certainly, you know, Tillerson has proved to be maybe better than, frankly, Pompeo. But that said, right, I think we are assuming that Trump even understands any of these things on anything other than a gut level. And frankly, where he has been in his foreign policy has been where he has always been. As I said, it's not just with this attitude towards alliances that go back to the 1980s. His attitudes about trade go back to the 1980s. And again, the target for Trump in the 80s when he first flirted with national office was Japan, but it was the same arguments. It was literally the same arguments he's making today about China. His like 19th century archaic throwback approach to power politics is again something that he has evidenced and expressed his entire public career. So at one level, we could sit here and drive ourselves crazy, I think, talking about all of the ways that Trump both misunderstands and undermines all of the things that we hold dear. But on the other hand, we shouldn't assume that he ever understood any of them to start with.
And I would just add to that, the other piece that's underlying a lot of what you just talked about, Pete, is that with the decimation of the State Department in terms of long-term personnel there, you know, long-serving personnel, and the elimination of that kind of expertise, both at the appointed levels as well as the career civil servant level, has just meant that the people that are the relationship builders, the ones that can call up the desk officer in Ukraine or in Beijing or wherever you're talking about and has a relationship with that individual, none of that's there anymore. And it was just, you know, decimated under Tillerson largely, okay, but it's been continued. And I think the last I had heard, what is it, something around 30% of the vacancies have still not been replaced over the last 4 years. I mean, it's just startling when you think about that.
And Secretary Pompeo has gone, I think, pretty far towards really politicizing what's left of the State Department.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, look, so we'll put it this way. If the next president is not Donald Trump, there's going to be a lot of cleanup to do.
Yeah. Now, Mark, you had highlighted the America First slogan and what that has meant. The last month or so, we've done several shows on conflict areas, places like the Eastern Mediterranean and the potential conflict between Turkey and Greece over Cyprus. And certainly, you know, the ongoing war now in Nagorno-Karabakh. And our experts all kind of used, at least one of the motifs was U.S. disengagement. And so I guess at one level, America First represents an American foreign policy tradition, but Pete had referenced this as a 19th century tradition, or at least early 20th century tradition of isolationism. So is this disengagement kind of an expression of U.S. isolationism and withdrawal, or is there something else that's driving these disengagements, which certainly seem to be leading to the potential for conflicts around the world?
I do think it's rooted in some sense of isolationism, but I also think it's, you know, based on a fallacy in a very interconnected world. You know, when we look at all of the things that even just the three of us and our colleagues do on a daily basis that interact with someone somewhere outside of the United States, we all know that those implications are there and those connections are there. And so by withdrawing from involvement in what's going on with regards to Turkey or what's going on with Azerbaijan or the list goes on, you know, you're just ignoring the connections that will have implications for American foreign policy. And I think in the end, part of the longer term negative outcome is that more and more countries are starting to recognize, and many of our allies, I would put in this category, are recognizing that they can get things done without us. For many years, they had to work with us because we were leading, we were a requisite player in many of these places. And now they're saying, well, you know, sometimes things are easier if the United States is not involved. And from even from a narrow American first perspective, that's probably not a good outcome for the long term.
Now, this is a really interesting point. There's a couple of things that sort of come to mind for me. One of them is Trump is very much sort of a crude realist. And I think if he pays attention to any of this stuff, the first question he asks is, what's in it for us? Or probably more even directly, what's in it for me? And if the answer is not much, then he doesn't really care. I mean, think about the way we so cavalierly kicked the Kurds to the curb in Syria, right? What was Trump's, I loved this excuse. Well, you know, where were they when we were storming the beaches of Normandy? So why should we stand by them today? So I think that first thing, right, this whole transactional side of realism comes into play in terms of the way that Trump thinks about these kinds of affairs, if he thinks about them at all. If there's nothing in it for the United States, he's not interested. Here's the second piece of that. In the late 1990s, there was actually, you know, a pretty persuasive argument that was being made in certain quarters of our discipline that the United States needed to come to grips with the reality that we were really no longer the indispensable country and that we should really take a serious look at scaling back those commitments and really only be tied into the things that are the most important. And as much as I hate to cite Samuel Huntington, he was one of the loud voices making this argument. I think the article that I make my students read is called The Lonely Superpower. And he essentially argues that the United States has this image of itself as being the indispensable country, and we're not. But because we think we are, it gets us into trouble. It means that we try to interpose our will in places where we don't really have any interests at stake, and it means that we overextend ourselves, and it's going to heighten our decline. As much as I think that Trump would love Huntington, especially his later work, I'm under no illusion that Trump has read any of those arguments. But this is not an implausible case to make, right? That the U.S. really isn't a hegemon, hasn't been a hegemon in a long time, and that we need to do some serious soul searching about just how central we are in world affairs. Now, does that mean that we just abandon the field to China, which has been very happy to jump into leadership positions in all of these institutions that we've backed away from? I don't know. But it's not an absolutely unreasonable case to make that perhaps we shouldn't be involved with Azerbaijan or Armenia.
Now, I remember in 2008, one of the key differences that I had found between McCain and Obama was that both of those candidates understood that there had been a relative decline in U.S. power. And we say it's gone back a long time. I certainly would highlight the Iraq War in 2003 as playing a pretty substantial role here. McCain had argued that because the U.S. wasn't being assertive enough, if they'd been more assertive, they could regain authority. Where Obama's approach was really quite different, was trying to manage American decline by using institutions, by using allies, and even the infamous phrase of leading from behind in places like Libya. I think we would all agree that there's been a relative, perhaps even an absolute, but certainly a relative decline vis-a-vis other countries. And President Trump certainly has suggested that the reason for that is stupid leaders, and we just need to assert ourselves, et cetera, or at other times we need to withdraw. But ultimately, is the president, and certainly whoever the president is after the 2020 election, what's the best way to deal with the reality of American decline? Is it to withdraw from certain areas, try to use alliances, return to rules-based order? What I think that's very much on the agenda for whoever the president is in 2020. I'll ask Mark, I'll ask you first.
I agree with your characterization of both McCain and Obama in 2008. But I would also say that both of them were sort of in the same part of the Venn diagram of the establishment foreign policy. And Trump is somewhere way outside of that diagram and of normality in American foreign policy, because it is looking at a very narrowly focused view, whether you want to call it transactional or the what's in it for me or us version of American foreign policy that doesn't work terribly well in a very globalized and interconnected world. And I think that if you're going to rebuild some of this, and this is certainly my liberal institutionalist bias is going to show up here, you need to be in a collaborative setting. You've got to shape the collaborations toward your own benefit and not just be outside bludgeoning your allies, bludgeoning your adversaries with outcomes that or with statements that don't get you anywhere, or go down blind alleys like talking to North Korea repeatedly on various issues. I mean, it was sort of nice theater, but did it actually accomplish anything? Not much.
You know, and I would say that there's sort of two things to think about, and it sort of brings us full circle back to where the conversation started. Multilateralism and institutionalism is really the way to go if you're not powerful enough to be the hegemon. The other thing to do is to pivot away from those parts of the world where your interests are more or increasingly peripheral and focus on those areas of the world where they're more central, which was we started to see towards the end of Obama's second term, you know, the Obama pivot towards Asia. It was sort of a recognition that we had squandered a lot of both goodwill and we had squandered a lot of, frankly, blood, sweat, toil, tears, and money in the Middle East. And it really wasn't going to pay off for us that long term. But where were the emerging challenges to sort of the U.S. position coming from? Well, they were coming from a surging China. You know, that's probably the smarter strategy. Embrace multilateralism and then focus your attention on those areas and issues where your interests are vital. I don't see a second Trump administration having the discipline to focus a foreign policy around any kind of grand strategic vision. I think that Joe Biden wouldn't be much more likely to do the kinds of, frankly, old-fashioned American foreign policy that people like us have long expected, and I think that has served the country well.
Now, Mark, one last key issue I want to raise. I know you do quite a bit of research in climate change adaptation, so any conversation here needs to address questions of climate change. And broadly on environmental issues, I think it's fair to say that the Trump administration has been much more hostile than certainly the Obama administration, although that has been a partisan divide within the U.S. Are we kind of stuck with the U.S. is going to cooperate on environmental issues like climate change if a Democrat's elected, but not if a Republican's elected? Or in doing work with adaptation, we've got some significant threats coming as a result of climate change. Could 2020 see the beginnings of possibly a bipartisan consensus on at least some need, at least to address adaptation, if not mitigation, on issues of climate change?
And this comes back to an interview I did with a climate activist about 4 or 5 years ago when I was really starting to get into this this topic. And her comment was, adaptation is the back door to mitigation. And in that idea, you're really talking about the fact that when you're dealing with severe weather, when you're dealing with storm surge, when you're dealing with drought, wildfires, the list goes on. And obviously, there are a lot of regional implications here and regionally specific implications. People are starting to get it because all of a sudden they're realizing that, geez, we're having a record-breaking Atlantic hurricane season. We're having record-breaking wildfires throughout the West. And these are now temporally being linked by most people in the public that these are climate-related impacts. And so I do think that that is pushing from below for local leaders, state leaders, to really move in a progressive direction on climate change. The Republican Party certainly isn't there yet. But I do think that if it's a Biden administration, we'll move faster into that area. If it's a second Trump administration, I'm horribly pessimistic, except for, just stopgap kinds of measures, emergency declarations, and things like that. The problem with all of this is that we're so far behind on dealing with greenhouse gas emissions that anything we do at this point is, it's not too late, but it's certainly playing a really bad hand in terms of where we're going to be. The real question is, are we going to have 5 degrees of temperature change, or are we just going to stick with what we're going to have now if we can control greenhouse gases moving forward?
And Mark Boyer, I'm going to need to let Mark have the last word on that as we are out of time. But I think it's fair to say, you know, sort of teasing out what's the main issues that are on the ballot, certainly multilateralism versus unilateralism, a certain professionalism and a return to foreign policy core principles, and certainly effective action on challenges like climate change are all very much on the ballot as it comes up. We've discussed the foreign policy issues in the 2020 election, and my guests have been Mark Boyer, who is the Board of Trustees Distinguished Professor of Geography at the University of Connecticut. He is also the Executive Director of the International Studies Association. And Peter Trumbore, who is the Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Oakland University. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.